This is the first of maybe more of some roundtable discussions on gaming industry topics, Las Vegas probably centric, but certainly we're not restricted to that. go around the room here. Jeff, why don't you tell us who you are and what you do?
I'm Jeff Simpson. I'm the business columnist and editor for the Las Vegas Sun and executive editor of In Business Las Vegas.
Great. Dave Schwartz, how about you?
I'm Dave Schwartz. I'm the director of the Center for Gaming Research at UNLV and the author of Roll the Bones, The History of Gambling.
Excellent. David?
Hi, David McKee. I'm managing editor of Huntington Press and author of the online Stiffs and Georges column.
Great. And Charles?
My name is Chuck Monster, a.k.a. Charles. I am the bonehead behind VegasTripping.com.
Great. And my name's Hunter Hilligus, and I run a website called RateVegas.com, including a blog called Two Way Hard 3. Thanks for everybody for being here. We're just going to get to it. And this is there's really no ground rules other than be kind to each other, or not even. That might be more interesting.
And don't talk about Fight Club.
Exactly. I think the first thing on the list is something that some of us have some personal experience with. It's this Columbia, Sussex, Tropicana, Las Vegas kind of ongoing issue. Now, Jeff, I know that you specifically have been sort of targeted by them after you wrote a column in the paper. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. Just by way of a little brief background. I've been covering Columbia Sussex since they entered the gambling business here in Las Vegas when they bought the former Maxim and built it into the Westin Casual Arena. And when they later pursued Aztar Corporation and acquired that company, which owned the Tropicana and the Ramada Express in Laughlin, I've covered them a little more closely since then, and have been less than impressed by some of their management decisions. They've been very aggressive in terms of cutting personnel and making what was a low-cost operation a very low-cost operation. Not usually it's not a typical path to success in such a service-oriented business. So I've been pretty tough on them in my weekly gaming column in the Sun. And in December, they lost their license in Atlantic City. And I wrote a very tough column then saying that Nevada regulators should look carefully at what New Jersey had done. And then 2 weeks ago, I wrote a column about some payroll problems that some culinary and non-culinary folks here in Las Vegas told me about, where they were told not to cash paychecks and a myriad other problems with their payroll, and wrote that column. And the company responded pretty forcefully with a full-page ad in the Las Vegas Review Journal. That's the other daily paper in Las Vegas. The Sun and RJ are delivered together as part of a joint operating agreement. And they wrote a full page ad, sort of on the surface criticizing me and my column, but the real point of their ad, it was a hit piece on the culinary. And, I think the subtext for this big disagreement is there is a very good chance that we're going to have a labor dispute that will turn pretty nasty this year sometime. I predict that it will end up in a strike. So, and then I responded last Sunday with a sort of defense of my column, and so that's where it stands.
Well, to go back to the Atlantic City thing for a minute, I mean, we know that I have a sort of a general understanding of the regulatory framework in Atlantic City versus or in New Jersey versus Nevada. And, it's my take, and please, I know Dave, you worked in Atlantic City, and that's your sort of your your hometown, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. So you probably have a better understanding than I do. But they're kind of – they take a more – would you think it's fair to say they take a more active role in those sort of issues, the regulators, as far as they actually have some kind of a clause about maintaining certain levels of service in the actual regulation framework?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, in Atlantic City, if you even want to adjust your security staffing levels, you have to submit that to the Casino Control Commission for approval, and they have to mull it over and decide if you can. So they have a much more activist role. Some would say maybe a little bit too activist, but basically I think what it comes down to is that the Columbia Sussex people told them, we're not going to cut staffing levels, we're just going to do it through attrition. Then they went and laid off a bunch of people. So basically they lied to the regulators, which is bad, and then they got Local 54, the Atlantic City version of the Culinary Union, mad, and the two of them kind of linked arms and then pushed Columbia Sussex over the edge, I think.
They got
two groups really mad who they shouldn't have.
It doesn't really seem like they have many friends. I mean, but at the, on the other side of the fence, Nevada is not really known for injecting themselves that way into the process, correct?
No, I don't think they are. I think it's much closer to something like a free market where they'll let you run, you know, they don't mind if you run a casino and offer $29 a night rooms.
Right.
You know, thank God, because otherwise Circus never would have gotten off the ground.
But
not only that, but they don't mind if you don't pay your bills. I mean, there's many examples of casinos that have, you know, gone into bankruptcy, that have, you know, lines of creditors, you know, around the block, Binion's Horseshoe, you know, a couple iterations of the Aladdin, and other properties that have, you know, really not conducted themselves probably in accordance with, you know, the finest business principles, but our state regulators take a very hands-off approach when it comes to management and labor management relations.
Right.
Short of being caught with insufficient cash in the casino cage, there is virtually nothing you can do that will get you shut down.
It seems like you kind of have to go pretty far out of your way, you know, Binion's-esque to really draw their fire. But now, in your guys' approach, and we can kind of go around the room per se, what is a better approach? What is better serves the interests of the state? Is it important for the regulators to be as hands-on as they are in New Jersey?
Well, in New Jersey, the casinos serve a public policy role. They explicitly are there to be engines of economic redevelopment. And so that's why they operate under these much more proactive set of rules. You know, in Nevada, you're dealing with a much more wide-open economic model, and may the best casino win. But I think it's really you really have to look at it in the context of whether the, you know, to what extent is the, you know, what, how the casino fits into each respective state's larger picture.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes any sense.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just interesting to see the contrast between the two. So how is this going to play out? I mean, obviously the Trop, they made some big noise when they were in the bidding process. And they, you know, obviously, for those that don't remember, it was a somewhat contentious bidding process between them and Pinnacle for the company and the site. The Tropicana Las Vegas site is obviously prime location. And some of the plans that they've talked about, and I think there's been some renderings floating around on the web. I think, Chuck, you had someone on your site. You know, they look pretty ambitious. I mean, it's like 2 jillion rooms over the entire.
They maintain that they're still planning to do it. There was a story in the Cincinnati Inquirer on Tuesday where their reporter talked to Bill Young, William Young, the CEO of Columbia Sussex, and he said that they still plan to build the biggest building in the world. It's not the biggest footprint for sure in terms of Las Vegas, but they plan to stick, you know, a, you know, what just, you know, other people in the business have casino executives have told me, you know, it sounds like a god awful plan, but that's what they supposedly still have in mind. Now, certainly, with given their situation, regulatory, and in terms of their bondholders and some other problems they have, certainly seems that they won't be lining up financing for that kind of a project anytime soon. One thing I'd like to get back to, Hunter, you mentioned about the regulatory, whether Nevada's system is appropriate. And I think I read something interesting in Dave Schwartz's blog back in December, where he, you know, sort of took a shot at New Jersey, and I understand that. I think that regulatory framework is not appropriate for Nevada, but I would say that, and I think it is, Nevada does have a different, we're a different state, and it's appropriate that we'd have a different sort of regulatory approach to what we allow and what we don't allow. But what I would say is that when a Nevada licensee is operating in other states, our regulators should pay those states the courtesy of respecting their regulatory decisions. And that's sort of a, and Dave didn't really address that, but I think that when operators choose to operate in those more closely scrutinized states, be it New Jersey or Missouri, and those are two of the states that are most often cited, Indiana, maybe another, for very, very strict regulation. When licensees choose to operate both in Nevada and in, you know, one or more of those other states, I think that our regulators owe it to our public, because it says right in our gaming rules that, and it's called the foreign gaming statutes in Nevada gaming law, that they have to follow the rules, and not just the rules, but the regulations and every other kind of, you know, ordinance and that in those jurisdictions, and that violating those rules in other states constitutes a violation of Nevada law. And, you know, we've seen it, you know, more than once here where companies that operate in Nevada violate other states' rules, and our regulators typically say, oh, they were penalized over there, so that's good enough. But I think that, you know, if that's true, then they should get that rule off the books here, because the idea was that we wanted our licensees to reflect well on Nevada. For companies that operate here, we want them to be beyond reproach. And yet companies time and again have been severely penalized. You know, and Columbia Sussex has been penalized in more than just New Jersey. They reneged on a deal in Missouri that made Missouri regulators tell them that they weren't welcome, and that if they tried to get licensed when they bought Aztar, that they wouldn't get licensed. So they ended up having to surrender their Aztar property in Caruthersville, Missouri. So this is a company that's already has an X and what would have been an X in Missouri. To me, that's two strikes, and I think that Nevada should pay close attention to what these other states have already said about the integrity of the company.
Oh, and well, under investigation in Indiana, all that's on hold because they say they're going to sell the Evansville boat. And
Indiana has a rule that I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that if you lose a license in another state, you're already forced to sell in Indiana. Indiana has a very tough rule, similar to what Nevada could do, but I think that Indiana is more likely to enforce that.
And getting back to the proposed remaking of the Tropicana here, there are two conflicting sets of designs floating around, which might be of interest to Hunter's readership. There's the rendering, which is on a couple of different websites, which I suspect was actually the end product of the $26 million Aztar redevelopment plan. It's certainly far more expensive looking. It would be more expensive to build than the design that can be found if you search for Tropicana architectural models, where you get something else a building that's much more rudimentary in design. It basically is just one gargantuan building covering the entire site. The podium level is of would stretch basically from one corner of the property to the other. And it's a much more, you know, plain vanilla style of construction. It doesn't have the rearward of the two towers. I keep getting their names mixed
right.
up. But I'd had an inside tip that that was going to be torn down as part of the Columbia Sussex plan.
The back tower is the Island Tower. I don't,
the Island Tower, yes.
Paradise, I think, is the other one.
Paradise, yeah, Paradise would remain. And the kicker to this whole thing is that Columbia Sussex maintains that they can build this 10,000-unit creation for no more than $3.5 billion.
That seems highly unlikely. I mean, to me, I look at the plant, I look at the plans, and it's like, I kind of consider any design where they're incorporating the existing structures as sort of a signal that these guys don't really know what is best for their long term interest. I mean, you've got a site that's that prime, and they're going to do something like leave some of those existing structures there. I mean, those are always going to be loser rooms. I mean, look at MGM
with the old marina,
right.
Marina and or Planet Hollywood with the former Aladdin Performing Arts Center, or Caesar's Palace with 900 add-ons, but never getting rid of some of the old towers.
It seems so short-sighted, especially, you know, for someone. For the perspective of Caesar's Palace, I guess I can sort of understand it because of the history there. But I mean, MGM Mirage has had to do this whole West Wing room thing to make those marina rooms marketable. I mean, they're pretty
pathetic. They're still not a good value.
Right. So it's like for them to say up front, we're going to keep these old structures, I mean, to me, that is like the first sign that these guys are going off the deep end.
Well, and I think there's a question to be raised here of what's going to happen to those structures once they start having to drive the pilings for these much larger towers that they intend to piggyback onto them. And then, I mean, they had sinkage issues across the street when Mandalay
right.
Bay was being built. So I think there are some unanswered questions as far as the practicality of it from an engineering standpoint.
So, I mean, how is this going to play out? Obviously, we saw what happened with the Cosmopolitan recently, and the fact that they are basically defaulting, and there's obviously some financing issues there with the condo market basically going completely limp. What's going to happen with Columbia Sussex? I mean, are they going to be forced to make some kind of exit out of the market, or are they actually going to pull through?
Well, my prediction would be, and this is just a prediction, but when, you know, because they're losing that huge chunk of their cash flow in Atlantic City, they're going to still, even after that casino, after they get paid back for that casino, or their creditors do get paid back, same thing with the Evansville property in Indiana. When those things, and I think they also have one in the South that they have to sell. So when those sales take place and the debt is repaid, they're probably going to have about $100 million a year in free cash flow, supporting about $1.3 billion in remaining debt, and that's just not sustainable. And this is just, you know, just a prediction, but it would not surprise me to see the company have to file for reorganization under bankruptcy protection. And that's something that I would be looking at closely. And one of the things people have speculated, oh, they could sell properties, but they only really have one really choice property left, and it's the Tropicana site. They can't, if they sell that, they're left with that motley collection of less than appealing properties and less than appealing markets. But that's, you know, so they really can't sell many of those. And so, you know, I just don't see a way for them out other than bankruptcy, but we'll see.
So let's say that they were forced to sell. Let's say they're forced to sell the Tropicana in Las Vegas. Who would be the likely suitors? I mean, obviously, MG Mirage would love to have that property. Anybody else that's positioned to take on something that large?
I think maybe you might want to look at Penn National with Tim Wilmott becoming the CEO. You know, I think maybe they're trying to make a play. You know, definitely with that Bader Field move in Atlantic City, they're trying, you know, they're offering to pay $800 million just for that site. So I think maybe they're trying to get in the game in a bigger way.
Depending upon the timing, if their Missouri properties are, you know, both open and throwing off cash, potentially Pinnacle. I don't know that the footprint is big enough for Sands to build a convention center there. If they could, you know, transfer their hotel plus convention center model, and they've done quite a lot on a pretty small footprint on their current turf in Las Vegas. So, you know, and they're a company obviously that can get access to cash. Right. MGM Mirage, because they're the, you know, they own the three corners there already. So, you know, there, I mean, certainly, and it's so close to the airport. It is a nice, though somewhat small location compared to the, you know, big master plan development sites that are becoming the new form of development on the Strip.
And maybe we'll get.
And don't forget Ameristar. It's true. I mean, true, they haven't operated successfully in the Vegas area yet, but they were one of the also-rans in the bidding war, and they've shown in other markets that they're a far more competent casino operator than Columbia Sussex. I mean, casinos
of course, that's
are
not
what,
saying much.
Well, yes, casinos are what Ameristar does, whereas to Columbia Sussex, they're just these mysterious machines that you reach into and pull out cash.
Yeah, and Ameristar has some pretty nice casinos, too, in the Midwest, at least the ones that I've been to. I think in every market that I've seen them in, they've really been the market leader or close to it. You know, they just know how to put together the architectural details and stuff, so they're kind of like the anti-Columbia Sussex.
Which, strangely enough, brings us right back to Jeff's point of entry for this, because they inherited their Missouri properties from Station when Station was a hair's breadth away from having its license yanked.
Right.
Which would have been an interesting situation to see what the Nevada gaming regulators would have.
Well, no, Nevada gaming regulators still considered it. I mean, it wasn't like Missouri did nothing. Missouri, you know, threatened them with license revocation, and so they sold the property or traded the properties, you know, for the what was then the reserve here in Las Vegas, plus cash, and but Nevada regulators opted to do nothing, saying, and they had sort of a 2-point argument, which was Missouri has a crazy system where they don't allow operators to talk to regulators, A, and B, they've been punished enough by having to sell their Kansas City and St. Charles suburban St. Louis riverboats. So yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, it sounds like the story is to be continued on the Columbia Sussex front. There's one other topic I wanted to hopefully get to here is the Monte Carlo fire and this issue of the exterior insulation finishing system or whatever that EIFS stands for. This whole issue of foam and the possibility of changing standards. So, you know, obviously we all saw some of you guys saw it in person. We all saw the fire at the Monte Carlo that was pretty dramatic. I mean, I was watching it on a webcam, and I was thinking to myself, man, this is amazing. I mean, this thing is just burning like it's made out of gasoline. So, of course, in the aftermath, we've heard stories about EIFS and how it's the manufacturers will tell you it's extremely safe, and that you know, maybe some procedures and rules weren't followed in terms of how the welding was done up top, and it seems to go round and round. So my question is, will we see any long-term fallout from what people saw on their TV screens? Because I know most people, just the layman that I've spoken with, has said, wow, I had no idea something like that was even possible. They're sort of shocked. They don't care about the what's of how it happened. They just know that they've stayed in those kinds of buildings many times, and it was pretty scary looking. So, you know, is anything going to change because of this fire? Are we going to see any changes in the codes? Are we going to see a forced any of the existing structures to be reclad or altered?
Only if the legislature mandates it.
You think that's the only way that we'll see any change?
Well, as far as the forced recladding, that's the only way it's going to happen unless, you know, unless companies take the initiative to do it, which I'd love to see.
So what buildings do you think are the most what are we talking about as far as older buildings that would potentially need to be reclad? I mean, obviously this stuff is used all over, but I think it, at least from what I've read, it sounds like only a handful of structures are in the category of potentially needing some work.
Well, I mean, from what I read on your site, Hunter, Bellagio would be at the top of the priority list.
Yeah. Well, you know what's interesting is from what I've been told and what I've read, it sounds like when you get into some of these custom-looking structures that are made out of this foam, like they, you know, some of the ornamental elements, less so than the large, you know, curtain wall type stuff, but some of these ornamental add-ons, it sounds like some of those are harder to fireproof because of the strange shape. And if you stay at Bellagio, and if you stay at on a floor that has some of those right outside the window, because some of the windows will have those ornamental elements right outside, I have been in those rooms and seen cracks, and the stuff is sort of coming apart, and it looks like styrofoam. And I can easily imagine a similar kind of scenario with that stuff starting to lighten. It sounds like once the fire gets inside there, it just kind of goes to town. I don't know. It seems like it's pretty scary in some of those scenarios.
Yeah, I think this is a case where nobody's really thought about this before, and it seems incredible to me that you could build a 300-foot building and not think about what would happen if the exterior caught fire just because of lightning strikes and things like that. But apparently they're more worried about the interior fire codes, and of course everything's up to code, you know. And I think that's going to be the stock response from the industry, is that everything is up to code. You know, the question is, do the codes cover what happens when this sort of thing bursts in the flame?
Well, and I think that what this, the Monte Carlo fire, could serve the purpose that the Hilton and MGM Grand fires did a couple decades ago, when the legislature forced the hotels to put sprinklers in every room. And probably it will be an issue that will be addressed. And I don't know that it has to be done legislatively. It may be that the fire marshal or the Clark County Fire Department has some kind of enforcement mechanism. I'm not really familiar with that. But if ever they're going to do it, they would need to do it, you know, right now while the fire's still fresh in folks' minds.
Yeah, well, you know, also – the Borgata Water Tower fire,
very similar,
not that long ago. I mean, that was, mm-hmm. I didn't realize until after the fact, when I went back to look at the photos of that, how, I mean, that also looked like a raging inferno. It was pretty intense looking from the photos. I mean, it does seem like this kind of stuff can happen, mm-hmm. and that it almost was sort of sounding a little bit like they're trying to be swept under the rug. I mean, nothing to see here, kind of look the other way.
Move along.
Yeah, exactly.
Except that if you look at some of the photo galleries of the exterior of the building, or you just drive by it on the interstate, the damage is far more extensive than people are being led to believe. I mean, there's places where on the bottom level of hotel rooms where you can see where the debris caught fire to bits of it on the way down. So they were very, very fortunate that it happened where it did in terms of the hotel, and thank God it was, this is going to sound strange, but thank God it was at the Monte Carlo and not the Palazzo. Can you imagine trying to fight a fire at the top of that building?
Sure. It's an excellent point. I mean, that, you know, kudos to the firefighters, because I was watching them, and it was just amazing. I mean, those guys obviously do whatever it takes to get it done, but man, talk about brave.
I think a trend, you know, one other way to look at it is, as you look at the kinds of properties that have recently been developed and are being developed, and I think, you know, certainly Encore and Wynn are not going to be susceptible to that kind of a problem. City Center shouldn't be either. Luxor. It may be as sort of these intensive themed properties are less popular, at least for the near in the near term. Maybe we'll see less structures having to use that kind of stuff on the outside.
Well, one property that's built to the old codes is Excalibur. But, I mean, you know, why bother to go to the expense of recladding it? Why not just knock it down?
Because it's 4,000 rooms, and you couldn't build 4,000 rooms nearly as much, and it throws off $100 million plus every year.
Yeah.
It's fun to talk bad about Excalibur, but it does make an awful lot of money for MGM Mirage.
Yeah, and, you know, and I don't think there's any – if they did build it, you know, rebuild it, to rebuild that many rooms, it would have to be upscale, and I think they're already so crowded there. Why do it?
Right. Now, well, you know, who knows? Maybe the themes are going away, but maybe they're going to go away faster than we thought because they're all going to burn down. to change topics here again, I think it was yesterday we had a Las Vegas Sands earnings call, and recently the company opened Palazzo in Las Vegas right next door to its sister property, the Venetian. They will be the first to let you know that together the combined properties, what they are apparently marketing to convention planners as Mega Center, I think is the
with
largest.
With all capital letters.
Indeed.
Mega largest Center.
I think it's the largest integrated hotel complex in the world with like 7,000 rooms plus or minus. I'm sure that most, if not all of us, have been to Palazzo now. I stayed there. It's official opening weekend, and I did write a report for my blog. And I'm curious to get other people's impressions of Palazzo. Personally, I would say, in a word, underwhelmed. There are parts of it I thought succeeded, but generally speaking, I was not impressed. And, you know, in my report, I was comparing it and contrasting it against Wynn Las Vegas and Bellagio. And, you know, one open question I have is that a fair comparison? You know, in some ways, I don't think it is because some of the market is different, but Las Vegas Sands casts it in that light. So, you know, on the other side, maybe it is fair to compare the $1.8 billion Palazzo to the $2.7 billion Wynn Las Vegas.
You know, Hunter, I think what they do is, and Sands sort of has a little bit of, you know, myopia when it comes to their own properties. They thought that the Venetian was the best property on the Strip, and, you know, they've used that kind of language with Palazzo. I think, and I typically compare the Venetian, and I think comparing the Venetian and Palazzo together, along with their convention facility, I think the logical comparison would be with Mandalay Bay and Luxor. You know, all connected with a retail component much smaller at Mandalay, much nicer and more extensive at Venetian and Palazzo. I think, as you know, I don't think either of those properties compete at the ultra high end with Bellagio, with Wynn, and soon with City Center and Encore. But I do think that as convention-oriented properties, clearly the best in the city, better than MGM and its smaller conference center, obviously way better than the Las Vegas Hilton and the convention center, and I think superior to Mandalay Bay. It's the hotel tower and through a walkway through the retail section, Luxor. I think that, you know, what they, I think that, and I agree with you, there are a lot of shortcomings you can pick out in Palazzo, but they accomplish what they want. It's a convention center driven hotel complex, and in that respect, I think they're going to get excellent daily room rates. It's going to make a lot of money. They're not going to get the, you know, the powerful high-end play that Wynn gets and that Bellagio, to a slightly lesser extent, gets. But I think that what they have excelled at is picking off great entertainment. They have, you know, Blue Man Group. They have Phantom, and they're soon going to have Jersey Boys. I think that's probably an unparalleled group of entertainers for one property or one, you know, sort of one site. And, you know, MGM Mirage, over its assortment of properties, most of them not connected, you know, can pull in the five Cirque shows plus individual stars. but nothing on the same footprint. I think restaurants, they do pretty well. They don't rank, I don't think they rank with MGM Grand, Bellagio, and Wynn, but they're pretty darn good, and their hotel product is certainly pretty darn good as well.
Yeah, well, you know, to be frank, I wanted to like the place before I walked in the door, and on its own, standing on its own, I think it does just fine. And in any other city, it would be, you know, hands down a winner. It's just, for me, it's the way they cast it against these other hotels.
It's tough to live up to their sort of distorted view. It's tough to live up to saying, oh, it's the finest hotel in the world. But, you know, it has a Barney's. It has great retail. In terms of Las Vegas, I think it fills its niche nicely. It's just not the niche that the owners think it fills.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I think looking at it from a design point of view, it's nothing really new. You know, and I think with Wynn and definitely with Encore, we're looking at stuff that's been new or at least seems new in Las Vegas. And I think Palazzo doesn't really do that. It does the standard casino resort convention thing really well, but it's nothing really that exciting.
After visiting the Venetian Macau, I kind of came to a realization that it's kind of like the Costco of casinos. It's a big box, big box stuff. You'll get your steaks, I guess, you know, but you'll have to buy 38 of them, and they'll be kind of fatty. And, you know, you don't really want to spend that much money, but you end up taking it home anyway, you know.
So it's
not what they say it is.
So Chuck, how was the foot traffic in Venetian Macau? I mean, did it look pretty well populated?
When I was there, it was, you know, the place was quite crowded. Mm-hmm. How the foot traffic is, you know, I think also is dependent on how you understand foot traffic. It seems like it's crowded, but that's because people can't find their way anywhere. Always bogged down, you know, just like the Venetian and MGM Grand in Vegas, you know, it bogs down wherever there's intersections. There's always just people stopped and staggered and looking around at this massive complex. You know, you think any casino is huge. You have no idea what huge is until you've been to the Venetian Macau. It's truly insanely large. So the tables, you know, when I was there, was probably about 70% of them were operational. So
I didn't have any problems finding my way around, you know, getting around Palazzo. Actually, I felt like Charlton Heston in the Omega Man. It was a very light crowd there.
I was surprised how light it was when I was there that first weekend. I mean, it was unbelievably almost empty.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've been there four times to date, and it definitely is much more lightly trafficked than Venetian. I think that as the convention schedule gets bigger, as more people, you know, get accustomed to the property, it should eventually sort of even out between Venetian and a lot of things in that place. You know, to be honest, still aren't open yet.
Well,
they don't have their show. They don't have a lot of the retail going. Some restaurants not open. So, you know, I mean, and that's sort of that company's way of doing it. And, you know, I think, you know, you're going to have to judge it 6 months from now, a year from now, 2 years from now. And, you know, it's a company that does things its own way. I mean, there's no other way around it. They believe that they have a technique, and it's really hard to argue with the long term success of their model. And you know, they have some other big, what I think are going to be pretty profitable ventures coming online. I think their Eastern Pennsylvania property at Bethworks in Bethlehem, they're going to have 5,000 slot machines in there, and if they spend $600-800 million a year, people I talk to say almost guaranteed to throw off a couple $100 million a year. That's going to be profitable. They're going to be one of the two license holders, and with the best location in Singapore, should also be a big money maker. So, you know, when people sort of say, oh, well, it's taking a while for Macau to go really strong, and that may be, and they do have a lot of additional capacity they're going to add in Macau, but this is a long, long, long-term play. You know, this is a company that is, you know, is getting as many straws into as many good drinks as it can. And I think that, you know, if you're betting against the long-term prospects of Macau, you're sort of betting against, you know, the dynamism of southern China and Hong Kong and, you know, nearby Asia. And I think that's a losing bet. I think that, you know, it's hard to criticize what that company's doing almost anywhere in the world.
I definitely agree with you in terms of them being successful in a financial sense. I'd mm-hmm. give them zero style points. And
well,
and
I think
you're kind of right there, at least with the Palazzo stuff. You know, I've seen some of the renderings for the Singapore project, and that looks really amazing from the outside. But, yeah, Palazzo, that big box of a casino, I think, makes it look less crowded than it actually is because it's so mm-hmm. big and open, and you just look around. And it doesn't – I don't know. That absolutely doesn't do anything for me, you know, compared to being in – being in Wynn Las Vegas and that open, and it was like, oh my God, wow, what's this here?
Well, it was sort of a quantum leap also.
Yeah.
I mean, a big change from the prior group of new resort openings.
I couldn't agree with both of David's points more. I mean, even when they have, you know, what would be a decent-sized crowd for a slightly smaller property looks sparse there because of the scale of the casino and the way it's been designed. Which is to draw attention to how big it is. And then when you have so much of the retail, I mean, you go up into that retail mall area on the second level, and it's a bit like a ghost town.
It is.
And very convoluted in its layout. And I frankly had one of those moments where should I even be back here? You know, is security going to come and throw us out? It's very.
At least they're consistent because they do that in Macau also.
Yeah.
There's lots of dead areas where you're like, what's this, huh? Waiting for the cops to come get you.
Mm-hmm.
They do it everywhere.
They're not openings are not their strong suit.
Apparently not. Well, okay. Before I let you guys go, I want to go over one more topic, and that is a quick round the room. On projects that are coming up. Obviously, there's some big projects coming up in Las Vegas over the next, you know, year, 2 years. City Center, Encore, Echelon, you know, all of these things. I'm curious to hear from each one of you. If you had to pick one project, which one is the most interesting to you for whatever reason that may be? And start, I don't know, Jeff, you want to start?
Well, I mean, clearly City Center is, to me, the most interesting. It has, I'm very interested to see what Bobby Baldwin is going to accomplish on his own from under the wing of Steve Wynn. I'm very interested to see what they're going to do in the retail that will have the Las Vegas Boulevard frontage. Their boutique hotel operators, Mandarin Oriental and the Harmon Group, I think that those hotels should give some extra pizzazz to the property. I think it's quite ambitious opening up the whole thing at once. And, you know, the live-in quality, although, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how lived in those places are. A lot of other living units, dwelling units near the Strip are pretty sparsely occupied most of the time. But I think that City Center, to me, is the one that I'm really waiting for. I mean, Encore is going to be, will be, I'm sure, a fantastic property. Wynn spending more than $1 million per room to build that, another leap ahead in terms of dollars. But, you know, to me, I think City Center remains the most exciting project that I'm waiting to see how it opens.
All right. Dave Schwartz.
Well, I think City Center is going to be really great, and that's, you know, if I had to bet on one of them to be the most successful, that's where my money is. But I'm really curious about Fontainebleau and seeing what happens there
sure.
because they've got the lineage of the whole Miami Modern concept and that classic hotel. So I'm really curious to see what happens there. Again, it looks like it could use a bigger footprint. It seems like they're building right out to the sidewalk, and I just want to see how they pull that off.
And Schaefer, you know, being off the scene for a while and coming back is kind of an interesting play as well, seeing him back in the Las Vegas mix.
Yeah, and I think that place is really going to take a lot of people by surprise.
Well, and when you say Schaefer, and you get Schaefer with money, I mean, when Schaefer was at at Mandalay, he was always building on the cheap and the very cheap, and still accomplishing pretty cool things on a budget, with a bigger budget and more ambitious, you know. And I think that Dave's right. Fontainebleau is, you know, is also going to be pretty darn interesting.
David McKee.
Oh, I'm going to hedge my bet here. I would say that, the one I'd rule out is Encore, because it looks so much like a rerun from the exterior of Wynn Las Vegas. And it's kind of depressing to see Steve Wynn starting to repeat himself from the design front. But I'd say City Center is intriguing because I think for the first time the Strip will look like a real city as opposed to kind of a great big theme park. It's going to have a transformative effect on how Las Vegas Boulevard looks. But I think Fontainebleau is more intriguing in the sense that Schaefer, I mean, when he built Mandalay Bay, there were a lot of skeptics. I mean, people said that a mega resort just wasn't in circus DNA, and they'd proved it twice over. And that one property turned the company's whole image around. Plus, you know, he's talking about reviving the reading room or making noises about bringing it back when Fontainebleau opens. So I have to give him some extra points for that.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that. That's interesting.
Yeah, the MGM is pulling the plug. Well, right. to mix technologies here, they're pulling the plug on the reading room.
Right. Chuck.
Well, I have to say, I'm really looking forward to any of the projects that Crown Limited has their fingers into. mostly based on my experience at Crown Macau. They just won a big design award this week with all sorts of people voting, and it's just truly, truly, truly a beautiful property. And I have very high expectations for what Crown Las Vegas might look like, and I think they've also got some investment in Fontainebleau also possibly.
$250 million for I think it's a 20% interest in Fontainebleau.
Yeah. So yeah. On a side, you know, I'm curious maybe if those companies might somehow get together, you know, in the future.
Well, the rumored footprint or the rumored sites are, I mean, Fontainebleau is where it is, and the supposed site for Crown would be directly north. So, I mean, certainly they could be integrated in some way, something that the Fontainebleau people have not wanted to confirm on the record. I would like, you know, in terms of the design of Encore, and I've, you know, in terms of the outside design, I mean, obviously it looks very similar to Wynn Las Vegas, and I think that's intentional. But I would say on the inside, I think that it will sort of continue what is really what separates Wynn Las Vegas from its competitors. There will be a lot of fantastic stuff in the inside, but the emphasis is going to be on the rooms and the pool. I'm fairly certain that property, when it opens, will drive visitation and create more excitement than Palazzo did. I think that I doubt that it will be as big of a factor as City Center and Fontainebleau and a year later Echelon, because those are even bigger projects. But I think I would say to David that Echelon is going to be the rooms, as nice as Wynn's rooms are, these are nicer, and almost everything on the inside is going to be very special, so similar to the way Wynn Las Vegas and Bellagio are now.
Well, I'll say that from the perspective of a customer, I'm probably the most interested in Encore. But from the perspective of the overall transformative effect of the project, I'm definitely very interested to see what MGM Mirage does with City Center, and specifically the main hotel. I'm much less interested in the condo hotels and the other fringe stuff around the edges. I'm very interested to see how the main hotel is going to shake out, especially, you know, what they do with some of their partners, like Wet Design. I think, you know, there's some potential for some some new landmark stuff that are don't miss little mini attractions here and there. So I that'll be fun to see how that unfolds. What I do think is interesting is that no one seems to be that keen on Echelon. I don't know if Boyd's been counted out.
No, I think it's just that it's another year away, and it's hard for me to say that it's more exciting than City Center. City Center is going to be the first of those, along with Fontainebleau, of the big projects. But Echelon, certainly, I think, you know, without a condominium component, will be pretty darn special as well.
Well, very good.
Echelon is it's very contingent on that Morgan's component as well, the two hotels they're committed to, and they seem to be sinking an awful lot of money into the Hard Rock. So I'm just, I remember liquidity was a big concern when they bought that place. So I don't know. I'm still convinced that there are more shoes to drop on the Echelon front.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see if the projects and if the project ends up being built in the current vein that it's been discussed. Well, hey everybody, I appreciate this. This was a lot of fun. I hope you guys had fun too. Let's go around. I want to give you guys an opportunity to tell people where they can find you, Jeff Simpson. If people want to read more of what you're writing, where should they look?
At our brand new redesigned website, LasVegasSun.com.
Awesome. Great job, guys.
And that's where my stuff is.
Great. Dave Schwartz?
I'm at www.dieiscast.com, and I've also got stuff popping up in Casino Connection and the Las Vegas Business Press every now and then.
Great. David McKee?
At LasVegasAdvisor.com and occasionally in City Life.
Great. And Chuck?
VegasTripping.com, and click on a million of those links up on the top and you'll find a bunch of mine up.
Very good. Well, thanks, everybody. Have a great weekend, and hopefully we can do this again sometime.
Thanks. Take care, guys.
Yeah.
You too.
You.
Bye-bye.
Bye.